And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
But yeah, so just, you know, like, quick background on us real quick, so you kind of know where we're at. Like I said, my brother Luke and I, obviously, you know, we're brothers. We grew up watching horror movies. You'll hear a lot of times we'll reference our dad who introduced us to Universals. I want to say, I don't know, I was probably four or two or three, and Luke had to be an infant, and then we were watching Universals growing up and stuff like that. So our experience when we're younger obviously is very connected. So sometimes we'll reference things that we get that some people don't, you know, kind of thing. And then so we're younger than Chris, over Chris's, were you 10 years older than us, Chris?
Yeah, I'm 57.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So Chris is 10 years older than me. So so he's the guy who, you know, during the early 80s when Luke and I were like little kids, he was the one going and doing all the things that we only had to go back and do, kind of thing. So, but yeah. So cool. just kind of give you an idea where we are. And now, obviously, I know, not personally know you, but I know you from In Search of Darkness and all those things like that, kind of thing. Like it's I mean, I've been telling these guys, I mean, they've all, I don't know if they've seen all of them, but I've been talking about that stuff since when I first did the first In Search of Darkness. I was like, you guys got to see this stuff. And a whole bunch of my friends have backed all those projects and stuff just from me saying, get on this stuff, kind of thing. So, you know, when we saw the slasher one coming up, I'm like, this is going to be cool, you know, kind of thing. So, but, you know.
Cool. Thank you for the support.
Of course. It's, you know, I'll be honest, is that our dad has been going through some medical stuff. And what happens is there'll be times I'll pop on, like I put on In Search of Tomorrow at the house. I just put it on the TV for him when he was home. And I said, Dad, just watch this, kind of thing. Well, because I'm there fixing things and, you know, changing batteries and doing all the stuff around the house I got to do. He's just got it on because he can't get out of bed. And he's like, I forgot about some of these movies because, again, we're going back to 1980. And he's like, I remember seeing that in the theater. I remember seeing that, like, kind of thing like that. It's just, you know, it's amazing when you go back and look at even things you kind of know about, how cool those memories come back, you know, kind of thing, which is just, you know, which is just great. So,
yeah, well, that's the kind of thing we want to try to recreate with Slasher Trash is, you know, we want to go back to the days when a lot of these movies were playing in theaters, or you could just get them on video down at the video store. I mean, obviously, they didn't look nearly as good on VHS as they do on the boutique Blu-rays that have been re-releasing some of them. And some of those Blu-rays even look better than they did when I saw them in theaters. I mean, prints were kind of, you know, back in the day, movies were released regionally. They would go city to city, and sometimes New York City would be like the tail end. You know, this print would have been all over the country. Then it finally made it to New York, and the prints were not in the best shape. Right. But, you know, that was kind of the joy of it. You're seeing these sort of battered prints that had made the rounds, and the movies were low budget enough already, and now they looked even more low budget because the prints were just in such bad shape.
So I didn't do an opening or anything. Chris, is this gonna be a problem? Like, we kind of started already talking.
I could do it all in post.
Okay, no problem. Because usually we do a whole opening and whatever kind of thing. Because usually we're talking about a certain movie and we give
we
our
did a
certain
we did yeah. kind of a version of our opening there. Yeah, you introducing everybody, so it's close enough.
Yeah,
we'll just say something like, "Hi, everybody."
Yeah. So, but you know, speaking about VHS, just kind of thing. That's where Luke kind of is in his wheelhouse, right?
Yeah, because that's one of the formats we do here on the show. We call the Horror Rack Hanger On. And basically, it's every movie I remember seeing on the horror rack when I was a kid, right on through when I was in college. I went to Clemson University in Clemson, South Carolina, and we had it started out as a movies. It was a cow themed video rental shop. I'd never seen another movies. Unfortunately, they became just a video gallery while I was there, and then eventually they closed. But they had a fantastic, as most of those little, independent or mom and pop video stores did, had a great horror section. So we've covered a lot of movies that have been on VHS. Mm-hmm. That's literally the only criteria, was that if it had a VHS release. I think our first one, Sleepaway Camp. I think it might have been the first Horror Rack Hanger On, which has been Cheese and Rice. That's got to be at least 7-8 years ago at this point that we've been doing those. And so, yeah, so it's amazing to me, because my affection for VHS just comes from being born in 1980. Like you said, Michael, these movies were commonplace on VHS. And I remember going to even the grocery store. We had an IGA, Jay and I did, growing mm-hmm. up in where we were in New York, that had the little movie section in the front, and looking at all the covers. I remember one trip looking at the cover to Monkey Shines and Silent Night, Deadly Night, right? Those are the ones that stick with your brain when you're like 7 or 8, right? So so now to see, not just, you mentioned the boutique labels releasing the Blu-rays, which is fantastic, but even outfits releasing things on VHS, right? Mm-hmm. Full Moon will sell you plenty of their Empire Video stuff on VHS. SRS Cinema will sell you their low-level indie trash on VHS now. And I just have to laugh, because it's a format that exists, and won because it was cheap, not because it was of any quality, but we all love it anyway.
I was leafing through my Michael Weldon Psychotronic video guide. I had it and was just sort of flipping. I had regot my copy of it and was flipping through it, and I'd also gotten the Phantom's Guide to Video, and it was just fun to read, about how it fun, and it brought back the memories of, as they were describing each movie. It was like, you can get here's the video, the VHS distributors that you can get this movie from, and this, and it was this whole, it was a detective work to find stuff in those days and find a place that would put it out, and two places would put them out, but some would have terrible VHS dubs and stuff like that. And it just, in the time period where that book has come out to where the accent, now when I'm reading through the Psychotronic Guide, I'll see a movie that I, sounds really interesting, that, I haven't memorized the book, so I write it down. I go onto the internet, and 9 times out of 10, in 10 minutes, I'm finding it somewhere. I got this book on Grindhouse.
You found it, and Vinegar Syndrome's putting it out on, and you can pre-order it.
Yep. Yeah. Back in the day, you would have movies that were legendary for 20, it would take me 20 years. It would take me going in college. I had a girlfriend who lived in New York City, and we would go down to, visit her parents, and I would go into the video stores and be like, oh my God. And she'd be just like, run free, go find some movies. And I would be like, do I want to watch Martin? I've been hearing about Martin all my life, but never been on HBO. And, I lived in a small town, and, we had a multiplex 20 miles away, but Martin wasn't going to be playing anywhere. There's no revival houses. It wasn't playing on TV or anything. And I would just go to New York City and go to town and watch all the stuff. Oh, do I watch Martin or do I watch Bloodsucking Freaks? I don't know which one,
Yeah.
So. Yeah, well, those books were great, because that was in the days before the internet, and you didn't have a ready resource aside from these books by these, both Michael and Joe were diehard fans, just pouring their love and all the information out into those pages. So I bought those books too, and I went to the video store all the time. And then when I started going to college in New York City, I suddenly was amidst, a city where almost everything played theatrically. I mean, I didn't brave the grindhouses too often, because they literally weren't safe some of the time, but this was in the post-Halloween era when they would play in legitimate movie theaters as well. And mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of the era slasher trash is celebrating, when slasher movies became very popular. Not all of them played theaters, but a lot of them did. But they just after Halloween came out, everybody wanted to make a slasher movie, because it was considered a commercial, you could make it cheaply. You didn't even need a lot of special effects like a werewolf movie might require. All you needed was like a killer, a really cool costume, a lot of fake blood, and a bunch of young actors to play the victims, and you were off for the races.
Yeah. Scout out a nice location and
right, yeah.
You're find a holiday you can tie into, or an isolated place to put everybody.
Having a parade,
That's it. Off you go.
Yeah, it's funny. It's one of the things my brother always mentions that on the other podcast that I was doing with my dad. It's called Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B movie podcast. We talk about like what. Why get on a soundstage? Look how great this looks. Like you just go and shoot those. Yeah. You know, I'm the Hideous Sun Demon is a perfect example. I know it's a much older kind of movie. Like they shot that in the desert because it's in the desert and we don't have to build it. You know, it was at the Roger Corman theory, light and get away, right?
Just let's get away.
Well, you had so many films like, you know, Friday the 13th, they filmed at a real working summer camp and so did Sleepaway Camp. But few of these films, you know, shot on sound stages. I mean, even the best example is My Bloody Valentine, where they really went into a real mine and shot there. And it added so much to the atmosphere.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, because we could just mention My Bloody Valentine. There was a time, obviously, when that movie was, what we got was all the cut up version and stuff like that. And then they put it all back together, right? Kind of thing. That's one of those things that I think, how to put this, when we kind of, when horror fans, real like diehard horror fans, we always want like all the extras, all the bits and pieces, all the gore, you know, kind of thing, all the Friday the 13th, the stuff that make the cutting room floor. Like those are the kind of things. And I mean, I know I can speak for like, you know, us, cause we don't say we're always looking for all those little things. I'm assuming that's probably permeated, your time, you know, having seen them when they were younger and then eventually seeing like, oh, what's that extra stuff? You know, you always hear about that stuff. And now so much stuff is available to us. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's great to be able to finally get that feeling of getting that complete version. There's always the, you know, this is the most complete version you can find because we have whatever. Do you ever feel, and I just want to throw that, you know, let's say, you can do My Bloody Valentine. Like the original that you saw that was cut and truncated, that always, to me, holds a special place, but I like the restored version so much better. Is there a movie that you can think of, like off the top of your head, maybe that like, man, I really loved it when I was a kid or when I was a young adult or whatever, that, and now the restored version is amazing, but I really love that truncated version.
Well, you know, the best example of that for me is not a slasher film. It's The Wicker Man.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. The Wicker Man came out. And they restored all these scenes. Well, not all these. There's maybe three or four scenes of Edward Woodward on the mainland before he gets on the plane and goes to the island. And it's really kind of on the nose. And it's a little kind of a blatant way to set up his character. And I think the movie works so much better when it introduces him as he's arriving on the island.
Right.
It makes it all of a piece. And it reveals his character through his interactions with the islanders. And, you know, I was watching it. I'm like, it's great to be able to see these scenes, but the movie is actually, I think, much better without them.
Yeah.
So that's the one example I can think of where having, again, it's always great to see scenes that were taken out. Also, Peter Jackson's King Kong, which I watched the 3-hour version, then I watched the 4-hour version. Mm-hmm. And again, it was like, I love seeing these scenes, but I can tell why Peter Jackson cut them because they were all repetitive. Like they echoed like situations and points that were made in other scenes that were better. So, you know, I like the shorter version. I mean, it's still 3 hours, but I like it better than the 4-hour version of King Kong.
Right.
If I ever did a fan edit, that would be, I would love to get Peter Jackson's King Kong down to like under 2 hours, a tight hour and 45 minutes. I think it would have been a lot.
I love the 3-hour version, man.
Yeah,
the 3-hour version too. To me is fantastic.
The more time I put anything out of that, the better. But like,
what I was going to say is that
level, I was like, if you could get this down to a tight hour and 45 minutes, it would be one of the craziest hour and 45 minutes ever had, you know?
Well, you know, it's funny because you talk about that. I'm digging back into the archives here. I want to say I read an interview with Adam Marcus, who's the director of Jason Goes to Hell.
Oh yeah.
And this was in Cine Fantastique magazine, and I want to say that he was talking about the like unrated cut of Jason mm-hmm. Goes to Hell and all the and that, and he said that he made a very interesting point that's always stuck with me. He goes, especially with horror movies, that you get these director's cuts, and yeah, you get the cool effects, but you probably also get stuff that probably should have been cut yeah. in the first place, right? It's like, we love it because we shot it. That doesn't mean it's best for the film. Yeah. He goes, yes, I understand you want to see the gruesome parts, but sometimes they're cut for other reasons other than the MPAA.
Oh, yeah, there are a lot of deleted scenes on Blu-rays I've seen where the scenes are interesting, but they don't really work right. in the context of the film.
Right, yeah.
And I always love you get an introduction from the director, and he's like, "Yeah, I'm glad we cut that."
Yeah, yeah. I know both Luke and Chris have read a lot, and so have I. The novelizations of films, like kind of thing, and they often will have the shooting scripts of what they're using, and you're like, "Oh, that sounds really cool," and then you realize you see the deleted scene, you're like, "Oh no, that wouldn't work. It sounded cool in the book, but it didn't sound so great. I know when it worked in the thing." So,
it's even funny, Jay, you talk about novelizations based on that. So one of the I try not to get too into Kickstarter because I end up with a pile of stuff, and yes. I'm looking next to my desk and I have a pile, literal pile. But there was a so Michael Johnson made a screenplay back in the 80s called Ripped to Shreds.
And oh, I remember
it
that. Yeah.
Yeah, it was going to star Russell Todd and Laurie Marie Taylor, who was from Friday the 13th Part 2. Well, this was made into a graphic novel, an OGN, using the script. And that Kickstarter was last year, and we've been getting updates. It's supposed to be due out later this year. So it just goes to this idea that you, like you said, in the post-Halloween world, mm-hmm. slashers were seen as a viable commercial entity, right? I mean, I'm reading a stat here that in 1982 there were in the trade papers 140 horror films announced, of which 45 were actually released.
Yeah,
right?
Well, so it's this. When I was growing up, I was lucky. I got Variety in my high school library.
Mm. So
even in junior high, I would go like up to the high school library to read Variety. And every time there was something like a Cannes Film Festival or the American Film Market, they'd put out these editions that were literally this thick. And they'd just be right. full of these full-page ads for all these horror films that were in development. You know, dozens upon dozens of them, many of which never got made. And there are people online now who are posting these things. You know, they kept these ads and they're putting them up. And some of them have actors attached and some of them don't. But they're all fascinating to see all these horror films that were going to be made but never did. And then yeah. there are the ones that I would see that I thought had never gotten made, but they were so obscure that they didn't turn up until years later on VHS.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Hammer was great with that. Hammer announced some of the most amazing yep. films that never got made at the
Zeppelin's,
end of theirs.
Zeppelins versus Pterodactyls.
Zeppelins versus Pterodactyls.
That's the poster I'm seeing in my head right
that's
now.
That's exactly yeah, the first thing in my head.
What is it? Yep. Day the Earth Cracked Open with Kali, yep. Devil Bride of Dracula, I think is one yeah. of them. So the regular show, I say regular, air quotes up to the microphone, but the regular show that I do is called Earth Destruction Directive, and it's about Japanese giant monsters. So the one that always sticks out to me of the unmade Hammer films, of course, is Nessie,
yes.
right? Because that was the co-production ostensibly with Hammer and Toho, which would have in my again, you know, you talk about it that in your mind it's this amazing thing, but it's like I know what Hammer was doing in the 70s, and I really know what Toho was doing in the 70s. It may not have been as good as I'm thinking in my head, so maybe it's for the best.
Yeah, well, Toho with Toho in the 60s, maybe in the 70s.
Yeah.
But also to your point about novelizations, I wrote the novelization of Nightmare, the Romano Scavolini movie.
Oh,
and yeah. While I didn't have the screenplay available to me, Severin Films, which put it out, got me a bunch of photos from scenes that never wound up in the film. And I read interviews with the director where he talked about a couple of them, because if you just novelize the film as it exists, it would probably be about 80 or 90 pages. So I needed to build it out with something. So I was able to kind of extrapolate from those photos the scenes that weren't used in the film, and then I just made up a bunch of stuff.
Sure.
I tried to really keep it true to the style of the movie, but I'm a huge novelizations fan, mm-hmm. and there Me were not too. A lot of slasher novelizations at the time. You know, there's Final Exam, there's Friday the 13th Part 3, but you know, movies like Prom Night and Terror Train and Happy Birthday to Me didn't get novelizations, and now they're actually
yep.
I love that we have this whole nostalgia novelization
yes.
trend. There, you know, there's an outfit that did Happy Birthday to Me and My Bloody Valentine novelizations, and there's a bunch of companies putting out novelizations and movies that never got them before. And some of them, they, I talked to Christian Francis of Echo One, and he says he works from the original script, but he does not add anything because he wants to keep it true to the vision of the filmmaker. And then you have at Severin, Brad Carter wrote 700 page novelizations of Night of the Zombies or Hell of the Living Dead and Rat's Night of Terror. And it's like, who'd have thought you could extrapolate, you know, 500 or 700 pages of plot out of those movies.
Right. Right.
So that, that's part of the fun of it is sometimes they just go crazy and add all kinds of new stuff. But I think the most famous version is or the most famous example is it's not a horror film, but The Abyss.
Yep.
The novelization is based on the original script, but that whole ending, which you never saw. And actually, the novelization of April Fool's Day has an entire third act that I don't know if they filmed it or not, but it was scripted, but it was not used in the film.
Yeah.
So you can read the novelization of April Fool's Day and see how they originally wanted it to end.
Yeah. I mean, that's always been the urban legend, right? That there's a whole end of that movie that we never saw. You know, where you know, kind of thing where it's like, oh no, then they actually kill everybody. And it's like, but we just watched like 80 something minutes. Like, what? You know, kind of thing.
Here's a little peek behind the curtain. April Fool's Day has been on the list of horror rack hangers on from the beginning. And my brother has vetoed it every single time for that reason. It's like, there's nothing really happens in this movie, man. I'm like, that's why we could talk about it.
No, the thing is this, is we're picking other movies that are like, so as Luke said, we had, there was a gas station that had a little video store in it. And then that became literally the guy who owned the gas station, like rented a store in another and made a whole video store and made more money where he sold the gas station. I do think a gas station, the only gas station on the road, we live in a small town. The only gas station was less profitable than the movie store. Right. But this is the '80s, you know, kind of thing. So the cover for April Fool's Day was one of those covers I remember seeing on the horror shelf, right? But we're doing movies as we're going through, like The Gate and things like that, that I remember so well. And they're, so we eventually get to everything. That's the whole point. We want to get to all those memories we have, but there's so many. And what happens is what we cover here does not exclude it from being covered somewhere else. You know what I'm saying? On our channel, I mean, it was wherever. There are times when Dad and I will have covered something on, like Dad and I were doing all, okay, so let's explain this. My dad told us flat out when we were younger, slasher movies are garbage. You don't watch that stuff. We watch real horror movies in this house. By the age of, well, let's see. So I was 4, Luke was 2. I saw Carpenter's The Thing when I was 5. Like, that was a movie I watched. And I love Carpenter's Thing. One of my favorite movies of all time, right?
Yeah, well, Dad showed it to us, so, you know.
Oh, yeah. Like Terminator, The Thing. Like, I mean, we saw, you name it. Like, Luke and I, this, and people sometimes get mad about this. Luke and I, with my parents, saw Predator with a sneak preview of RoboCop in the movie theater.
Nice.
Yeah.
The best movie experience of my entire life.
Yeah, right before mine.
Wow.
Yeah, right. Right before my 7th birthday.
Right. Literally, he's not even 7. So he's 6. I'm 8. You know, and we're there. And then all of our friends are like, you saw that? I'm like, we saw it in the theater, brah. Like, kind of thing. That's.
Well, we didn't say brah, but
we didn't say brah back in the day. We said dude, you know, kind of thing. But that's what it was. Like, we grew up on those things. But our dad was very adamant that slasher movies were garbage. We don't watch them. The only one he even liked. Well, I should say there's two. He liked the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which he saw at a midnight screening. Like one of our family friends said, hey, come to me. Let's go watch. They saw Texas Chainsaw Massacre in the little mom and pop movie theater in the next town over at a midnight screening, which has got to be nuts because that you couldn't see that any other way. Right. And he said Halloween was really good, but all the other ones suck. And he flat out told us that. So Luke and I were like, well, they suck. Dad says they suck. They must suck.
We were all listening to Siskel and Ebert in those days.
Well, no, we never listened to Siskel and Ebert because those two guys knew nothing because they said Predator wasn't any good. And I was like, you don't know anything. You know, what is that? That's the old show. I'm like, it's a wrestling.
Oh, no, thing. I used to follow their word like it was gospel. And now I go watch their old shows and go like, what are you guys thinking?
Right. Yeah. so it's one of those things. So growing up in New York.
Well, that was always the strength of not just you know, these films getting made and released to mainstream theater, but then also playing on over the air television and then eventually cable, right? Because, you know, I remember seeing A Nightmare on Elm Street on, I'm going to get this wrong, Channel 5 WNYW out of New York before it was Fox, just a Saturday afternoon movie, right?
And I remember cut to absolute ribbons.
Of course. But I also remember seeing on, it was a Friday night, and it was Friday the 13th part 5 and part 7 on USA Network.
Up all night.
Right? And those were the first two Friday the 13ths I saw. So it's funny that well, hey, you know what? When you don't know anything,
Seven's
you're
my
like,
favorite.
This is
so
awesome. This is the greatest thing ever.
Well, I think a lot of the people, I think you have to start young to be the real horror, you know, the super horror fans always had a parent or some sort of, or a friend's parent or something. Me, I got my trauma real young.
Yeah.
At the local library. They used to, I mean, I had to be like 9 or 10.
There was a guy in a coat.
Old.
Don't tell anybody.
Yeah. Well, they in the beginning of the remake of Candyman, the library system had 16 mil. You could sign out 16 millimeter movies, and they knew the way to get the kids in. I lived at the library, so I was there for everything. But the way they could get the kids in is, you know, they would get a bunch of 16 millimeter movies and show them. And it was a Halloween, and the first two ones that they got were Hardware Wars and I think Gross Encounters of the Nerd Kind. And
oh,
they
I remember
those.
In the library, yep.
And I was one of the older kids there watching these. And then they had these condensation versions of like the Invisible Man. They would be like 15 minute
mm-hmm. oh, the old like digest. The old like the old Super 8 ones,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but they were 16 millimeter, but right, yeah, right, and right. Sound. And there was one of them, I can never remember the name of the movie, but it was one of the, you know, head in a jar of saline solution, monster in the closet, monster comes out at the end, kills everybody. That
the brain that wouldn't die.
Brain that wouldn't die. Yeah.
Yes, and it's a brain that wouldn't die. And
Jan
and
the Pan.
And that was that was freaking us out a little bit, but then it was Night of the Living Dead. And we had this probably 17, 18-year-old librarian girl, you know, probably 19 or 20, you know. And she puts on and I was like, at 9 years old, I was the oldest kid there. And I had never seen anything like that movie before. And so, you know, we're watching it and everybody's getting scared. And then it gets to the end of the first reel is when the first half of the movie was when the people got cooked in the car and they started eating. And so midpoint of the movie, two little girls have locked themselves in the bathroom and are crying.
Oh, God.
And like others have run out. And the woman's like, I don't think I can show the rest of this movie. And the rest of us were like, you have to show the rest of this movie. And like, I got so obsessed with it that I would sign it out of the library, sign out a 16 millimeter projector and take it back to my house and watch that movie over and over again.
Didn't Ebert tell a story
that
about
traumatized me, and I was hooked on horror movies.
We talked briefly about Roger Ebert. Didn't Ebert have a story, and he wrote in an article about going showing of Night of the Living Dead with the kids
and a matinee of it, and like people were just dropping their kids off to it like it was a typical Saturday matinee horror film. And the kids didn't know what hit them. It was it traumatized. And I could see that because it's like no one had ever seen a horror movie like that. No one knew what to expect when they dropped their kids off there. But I mean, Ebert's a big fan of the film. He was just basically saying, like, what are parents thinking dropping their unaccompanied 8 and 9 year olds off to see this movie?
Yeah. I saw the effects of it and it was not pretty. But yeah. I'm very happy that happened. I mean, after that happened, I became obsessed with seeing Dawn of the Dead. I was
And
Ebert was also plugging that one up good too. So like he was saying, don't take your kids to this one, but it's really good, you know. But just be prepared if you're not into the. And I was just like, I have to see this one.
So Michael, I want to ask your opinion on this. You mentioned the kind of neo retro novelizations and you know, a lot of the old 80s slashers have started coming back in odd ways. I think the most interesting one to me is the Stop the Killer which is a franchise of games. They have a Happy Birthday to Me. They have a Candyman Farewell to the Flesh and a few others. This kind of revitalization of slashers, right? I mean, everything from Child's Play getting adapted into a TV show. You know, I see people on the street wearing Michael Myers and Freddy Krueger T-shirts, just normal looking people, right?
I go to stores and there's Friday the 13th hats, you know, caps.
But is that? Do you think that's part of like this general wave of 80s and 90s nostalgia that all of us now that we're kids in the 80s and 90s now we have disposable income, or is you know, what's your take on kind of the retro popularity now of these old slashers?
I think it's definitely people who grew up seeing these films. I mean, I'm old enough to have seen them in the theater, but there's a generation that came maybe 10 years later that discovered them on video. Right. And they're a lot more accessible that way. I mean, if you were going to go see in the theater, I mean, I was lucky enough to find a couple of theaters in my area that starting about the age of 14, I could get in without a parent. But, you know, going to a video store and renting, it's a lot easier than trying to get it because, you know, you have to get in your car and go to a theater. A lot of people have video stores like in walking distance. And so I think a lot of people who grew up with them in the 90s or maybe even later on video are now kind of celebrating them. And it is, I think, part of the whole wave of 80s nostalgia. But then again, you know, back in the 80s when the Nightmare on Elm Street films, when the sequels were coming out, Freddy became a huge merchandising monster. Yeah. Like after the second or third film, there was Freddy merch everywhere. And you know, I was at Fangoria starting in 1990, and I heard that in the late 80s, any magazine with Freddy on the cover would sell.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, like, you had some magazines that came out trying to compete with Fango because, like, you know, anything with Freddy on the cover was a guaranteed sale. So that was the beginning of it. But now it's, you know, you've got merch from on every obscure slasher. You can find T-shirts for Sleepaway Camp and The Burning and all these other films.
Yeah.
And I think it is... It is part of a larger wave of 80s nostalgia, but I think because one of the things is that slasher movies, and I think that's something we're going to try to address in the documentary, they were the forbidden fruit of horror films.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, horror films in general were considered not good for kids, but slasher movies especially. Like, they were the ones you really didn't want kids to see, even more so than something like The Thing or The Howling or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, when you tell kids they can't see something, that's what they want to see. Mm-hmm. And so... Yeah, I think the forbidden fruit aspect of specifically the slasher films of the 80s is what helped make them so attractive to a lot of young viewers. And again, in Slasher Trash, we're going to be kind of talking about like the craziness of these films and what made them so controversial. We're probably going to talk a little bit about Siskel and Ebert and also Video Nasties in England. I mean, lots of horror films are Video Nasties, but certainly there are quite a few slasher movies in there.
Yeah,
But you know, slashers were kind of the ugly stepchildren of a genre that was considered an ugly stepchild in the 80s already. You know, horror was not as respected as it is now.
Right.
It's funny because that's almost, to me, the same sort of thing we saw in the 2000s with, and I'm going to use a phrase that I personally don't agree with, but that's the common vernacular. That's the same way that like air quotes up to the mic again, mainstream horror press and so forth look down on the so-called torture porn movies, right? It's like, we can show you any J-horror remake we want, any Blair Witch wannabe, any, you know, kind of slick PG-13 horror, you know, teeny bopper horror, but holy crap, if you've got some guy, you know, chained up in a bathroom, that's just bottom of the barrel. We can't have that. We can't have that. We could have a guy taking a dump in a bathroom in a Friday the 13th sequel, but we can't have a guy with a manacle on his leg.
Damn enchiladas.
That's probably the most disgusting scene in any of my
movies. It is. So bad.
That and the fat guy in three who goes and takes a crap and doesn't wash his hands. It's like, dude, what? Oh my. I can't. I was like, I remember, look, like we covered Cannibal Holocaust. I said I needed a shower. Then Friday the 13th part three, I said I need an even bigger shower after that. Oh,
yeah.
There's a certain amount of bathroom shenanigans in the Friday movies. Yeah.
Like, I'm willing to buy the killer coming back from the dead, killing everything. But you didn't wash your hands. That's a bridge too far.
No.
I'm sorry, bro.
It's too far.
They cut that part out. It's not important to the plot.
Right, exactly. It's so right. Nice.
It's like you go to a brothel and it says employees must wash hands. If they don't have that sign, right, you got to leave. But it's funny you talk about the forbidden fruit, right? Because my oldest, she is 17 and she is a budding horror fan, right? And so we're trying to show her classics, and we watched literally last weekend A Nightmare on Elm Street. And so what'd you think? He goes, that wasn't too bad. And it's like, we have become so jaded to these films that, again, were...
It's been copied so many times.
Right. That's exactly what she and her girlfriend watched Halloween. They said the same thing. It's like, well, you know, everybody acts kind of dumb. I'm like, you don't get the context here. But you're right. These were the movies that they were so, you know, vilified and so, you know, concerned and panic-ridden. But it's like, you know, the response may or may not have been that, right? That part of that was just selling the sizzle on some of these.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, for example, you have a remake of Silent Night, Deadly Night coming out soon, and no one has objected to it the way everyone objected to the first one.
To be honest, because again, sorry not to cut you off, but we were talking about the novelizations, and I actually read the novelization of Silent Night, Deadly Night, which I thought added a lot to like this, the paranoia and the psyche and all the stuff that was going on inside his head. And I'm thinking to myself going, like, obviously you can't put it all on the screen. You can't have all the inner dialogue and stuff on the screen. And I'm reading this going, okay, like, this is like the movie we got, like, you know, kind of thing, which I was very young, but I remember how intense the hatred was and how we have to ban it. We have to save the children. Mm-hmm. And I'm reading this novelization going, wow, this is really like going in depth and all this stuff that's really insightful. It's like, this isn't, I mean, it's still the same story, right? Everything's still at this core the same, but this is so much deeper than that movie actually is that people have. But there's people who talk about like that movie who never saw it, but they knew it was so horrible. It's the, and Luke knows where I'm going with this. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre shows you nothing. The blood, the most blood you see in that movie is when she falls and skins herself in the thorn bushes, right? But in your mind's eye, you see that hook go through her chest. You see them do, like, it doesn't happen though. And that's part of the problem. But that's why I think so many people, because even though they knew, like, well, there's a guy with a chainsaw going to kill people, and their minds started filling in this horrific thing that was never there, that they said, we can't let kids see this. And that's why it became so much more taboo. The slasher became so much more taboo.
Everything. That was the same time everybody was saying the same thing about heavy metal music, you know.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Destroying. Yeah.
So what do horror movies do? They start making heavy metal horror movies.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Right.
Both in there.
That's right.
And that'll draw the kids even more, you know. So you need to, it's hard to get that reaction these days.
Right.
You know, when
Part of the objection to Silent Night, Deadly Night was because of the advertising.
Yeah.
Because they were showing ads with Santa Claus as a killer, like during like Family Hour on TV. Yep. And it's interesting because it's kind of similar to, I don't know if you remember, there's a movie called Cuties that came out on Netflix. Yep.
Yes. And
a lot of the objection to that was based on these ads that they came up with, which were incredibly inappropriate. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what they were thinking, but so many more people saw the ads than saw the movie.
Right.
And that's, I think, part of the reason there's so much controversy is these ads got out to people who might never have seen the film. And the same was Silent Night, Deadly Night. Like, mm-hmm. most of these parents, you know, they would never take their kids to see this movie. But this ad was showing up, you know, during Sunday afternoon football or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, yep. you know, it was
and
the advertising.
Having
that
Santa
really...
conversation with your kids.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, because I remember, and I wrote a chapter about this for Kayla Janice's book, Yuletide Terror. And the MPAA actually rejected the TV ad multiple times until they added a line where the narrator says, he only looks like Santa Claus. Like, that was not in the original commercial. The MPAA made them put that there. And then there's another case, actually. I don't know if you remember a movie called Dogs from 1977.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That movie was rated R, not because it was violent, but solely because kids seeing dogs attacking people would mm-hmm. would traumatize them.
Oh yeah.
The idea of, and the commercials for that were also, I think, restricted because, like, if a kid sees this commercial and the family pet is like jumping and attacking somebody. So, you know, the advertising, and then there were cases where they had to be toned down, like Friday the 13th, the final chapter, the first print ad had Jason's mask with a knife through the eye hole and blood on it. And then the MPAA said, wait a minute, we didn't approve that. And then the next week, the ad is just a hockey mask.
Mm-hmm.
So quite a bit of the controversy with these films had to do with the way they were marketed. You know, sometimes the marketing was intentionally inappropriate, sometimes accidentally, but, you know, these ads were out there being seen by little viewers who would never see the films themselves.
Yeah, but so some of that, sorry, Luke. Yeah.
No, go ahead.
They're saying some of that, though, too. I mean, obviously, you said sometimes intentional, sometimes not intentional. But the idea that, what is it? You know, there's two sayings, like controversy creates cash. And, you know, the other thing is like, no press is bad. You know, any press is good press, you know, kind of thing. Right. If you're talking about our movie, even if it's, you know, I mean, I remember, and again, and I think it was in Going to Pieces, the documentary about slasher movies that had come back, you know, well, good Lord, probably 10 years ago, at least now, if not more, yeah. Right. So old dog, I can't remember these things. But where they were like, people were like on the news talking about, we have to stop this. Like, so when the 6 o'clock news has a piece at the end about how we have to stop this movie, you now have given me free press that I could never pay
yes.
for, you know? And that just creates all this buzz. And again, it's one of those things that, like I said, we grew up never having really watched slasher until we got a little older. When we got a little older than that, we had actually started going to Chiller, the horror convention in New Jersey,
yeah.
Which I'm sure you've been to, right?
That's when it was actually a horror convention.
Yes. Now it's a swap meet. Sorry,
yes.
Guys.
Well, it's an autograph show.
Yes.
Which is not, yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that, but right. It's not horror centric anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
So I remember going and hearing about movies that I didn't have access to. The Burning was the perfect example. I just had no access to The Burning, and it wasn't out on DVD yet. And I didn't have a VHS of it. And I had a buddy who, how to put this nicely, worked in the gray market. Is that a nice way to say that? We all yeah. know what we're talking
That's
about.
A nice we all know what you're talking way. About.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he said, hey, Jay, I got the movie you're looking for. And I was like, you have The Burning? He goes, I have one copy. And some guy's like, I'll give you $20 for it. I'm like, dude, I've been waiting for this forever. He actually had to get it. He didn't have a good copy. He got it from somebody else who had a copy, and he went and made a copy for me. And I'm like, I have been waiting to see this movie forever, because in my head, it had been built up and built up. And it does not disappoint. I love The Burning. It's one of my favorites, right? But that's the idea that, like, there were things that you heard bits and pieces of, and you started hearing about it, but it was like, I couldn't see it. And if I couldn't see it, like, all of a sudden I'm now there, like, there's a scene where he's going to cut these guys' fingers off, and it's all, and it just becomes bigger than it was. And when it delivers on that, you feel, oh my God, this is great. But so, and I think you could agree with this, there's so many of those movies just like their hype was here, but they just couldn't get there because of whatever,
well,
you know?
Yeah. That's,
but
that's the way you had to sell it in those days.
Right. And then I'm trying to remember, was it Graduation Day? Which is the one where they timed out the kills, where it's literally timed out every so many minutes you had to have a kill, and then you had to have a kill again. That was
There's the killer like timing things with a stopwatch.
Yeah, but I'm trying to remember who the director was. He literally said they timed it out, and they knew every so many minutes you had to have a kill. And then And they made the movie literally that. And what they said that was exactly like, and it's kind of funny because if you watch Maniac, it has this in it, right? It's literally the connection between that, the slasher movie, and porn. And it's, and you know, I mean, obviously, Will Lusting, you know, kind of thing, you know, there's that connection always there anyway, right? Kind of thing with that kind of seedy underbelly that is in Maniac and stuff like that. The kills happen, and then, you know, the kill happens, and then you had to build along it back up. And that's what they noticed. They were this timing it out when they looked at those kind of things, that slasher movies, the most successful ones, had that almost perfect timing in them. And it got the crowd all the way up and let them come back down, and then got them up again. And it works so well. And it's so funny when you think about it, that those things work so beautifully that, some people didn't realize that. They just kind of like threw it all at the wall and saw what stuck. And then some people started actually analyzing and thinking, how can I make the, I may not have the biggest budget. I don't have, you know, the whatever. How can I make this the most effective horror, you know, slasher movie possible, where slasher is such a different world than other types of horror? You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, kind of thing where, you know, and I'm not saying you couldn't have a slow burn kind of thing, but slow burn horror movies are built differently than slasher movies, you know,
they
kind
had
of thing.
Formulas for nudity and stuff. Mm-hmm. Then it was, you know, it was funny. My roommate worked on a movie with Fred Olen Ray once, which is funny.
Fred Onion
because
Ray.
I'm the one who went to film school, and she was getting jobs in Buffalo working on indie movies. And, And she came home and she's like, I'm doing a Lifetime movie. I'm like, oh, really? She's like, yeah, it's this weird director. It's this guy. What's his name? She's like, Fred Olen Ray. And I'm like, you're working with Fred Olen Ray? Oh, boy. And that, but they were talking. I was, and you know, from that point on, you know, you see Fred Olen Ray's like in any psychotronic, his name is just everywhere. And a couple people on a horror podcast were talking about it, and Fred Olen Ray came up, and they were like, you know, Fred Olen Ray used to do, you know, he does a million movies, but he would do that so he could get enough money to make his,
The
you
movies
know,
you
a goofy
wanted.
movie. You know, he'd get to do a movie where he'd have some starlets on set and have them get naked. You're like, can you even make movies like that anymore? Does anybody even want to watch that with, you know, full porn on available on the internet at all times? Or is there any market for, you know, that? Oh, there's going to be some boobs in the, there's going to be some boobs in this movie. That used to be, there used to be a whole
That used to
market
be
for
the
that.
marketing. That used to be the entire thing.
And so one of the things we had talked about this, we actually talked about this ourselves a while ago. When you look at like the sci-fi movies, like the, you know, the directors who are making the, like the movie of the week kind of thing, right? Then, and all from the very Roger Corman kind of idea of movie making, right? And then you look at all the Lifetime or the, like the Hallmark movies, not Lifetime, Hallmark movies, the Christmas movies and stuff. And they kind of churn them out, and they're all kind of like the one thing I can say is that like those things, obviously, you kind of see those cookie cutter kind of things coming out. Even though we were just talking about like the timing of like slasher movies and like the kills and stuff like that, the idea that, you know, if you had a holiday to tie it into, like that became the cliche, right? Kind of thing. Like, you know, like welcome to Groundhog's Day. You know, it's like what you're like, how is that there? You know, kind of thing. Like it's what it, you know, those kind of things work. And I think what we got, you know, sometimes, you know, was it obviously, I mean Halloween, obviously, but like you have, you know, Christmas, and you have like, I mean, we would get like, you know, your birthday or whatever, like all those things kind of work because those are things that you can connect with. You know, kind of thing. Anybody, you know, everyone has a birthday. Everyone knows when Christmas is. Everyone knows when these things are. It helps connect it. And the using that as the through line through those movies, I think was kind of brilliant on their part. Like why reinvent the wheel every time? You know what I'm saying? It doesn't hurt to kind of work that idea. It just started getting hard when you're running out of day, you know, things and Arbor Day, you know, I just don't know if you have a lot of those out there, but
You know, we talked about Silent Night, Deadly Night. I mean, we've gone from Silent Night, Deadly Night being that it has to be banned to save the children to Garbage Day being an internet meme.
And I actually saw that movie in the theater when it first came out. I'm very proud of the fact that I saw it for its 1 week run in New York City. But and I remember again back in the day, you had no reference sometimes when you went to see these things. You just saw the ad. There was no coverage, and you just went. And so I'm sitting there watching like this is the original movie, just like with a few interstitials. And then it gets to the second half where it has this guy overacting his fool head off, going around and. Yeah, that's another one of the creative kill movies where he like kills people with an umbrella and with I think like
Doesn't
car
he kill somebody
battery
with a car
charges and
battery?
stuff. And then he gets to the garbage day scene, which is
So
it's made for viewing in Times
it
Square. That's
is.
made to make a Times
I
Square
saw it.
audience
I'm
go
sitting about,
nuts.
I'm sitting like right outside Times Square. I'm about 3 blocks from the theater where I saw Silent Night, Deadly Night
Oh
Part
man.
Two,
It's a
back in.
different Times Square than then though. For
Because
sure.
they of course appropriately enough released it in April I think of 1987, so which is the perfect time to release a Crips. I mean this was really just like a brief stop on the way to direct to video for that movie, but at the time again I mean part of the fun of these movies is like I've told the story before about going to see Pieces with no idea what I was walking into because there had been no coverage of that. There are practically no names in the billing block on the ad. All I knew was oh it's a movie about chainsaw massacres and seeing that with a pretty good crowd, none of us knowing what to expect and being subjected to that. That's one of the things, again, in Slasher Trash, we want to talk about the craziness of some of these films, how some of them just went for broke and went nuts with it, and how entertaining that could be to sit in a theater watching Pieces and especially getting to that final bit and being like, what am I watching? This is, or the, I remember when the Kung Fu professor comes out and starts doing Bruce Lee moves. I'm like, what? We're all like, what the hell are we looking at? This is crazy.
Yeah.
Those are the golden moments of cinema. I mean, I lived in a cultural vacuum. You know, we had no, if you were going to hear about a movie, you heard about it on Siskel and Ebert or on the Today Show from Gene Shalit, and nothing else. So like, I would end up going. I remember going to the theater with my friends, and Big Trouble in Little China was there, and I was obsessed with John Carpenter at the time because he was born in my hometown. So there were rumors that, oh, you know, he based Halloween on this woman that was stabbed near the library, and she died on his doorstep. He crawled from the library and died. It was total bullshit. It's small town lore of John Carpenter. But I was obsessed with John Carpenter movies, and especially after Halloween. Mm-hmm. And we were in the theater, and we're like, what are we going to see? And I'm like, we're going to see Big Trouble in Little China. They're like, what the hell is that? I'm like, I don't know. It's directed by John Carpenter, though, mm-hmm. and we're going to go see it. And they're like, oh, I had to drag them in. And in the first 5 minutes, they were just like, this is the greatest, you know, when he's does the thing with the electricity between his hands, they're like, what is going on here? What is happening with this? And it was one of the most glorious times in the movie because we had no idea that we were walking in.
Well, the 80s was a great time to grow up when I did, because I was a Carpenter fan too after Halloween, and Carpenter had a movie out almost every year in the 80s. Mm-hmm. Like every year he had a new movie out, and I would go to see every one of them. It was much fun.
And they pretty much didn't. I was a little disappointed by The Fog, but I love The Fog now, you know.
Oh, The Fog gets better every time I see it. Mm-hmm. That movie really improves on repeat viewings.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things though. And this is, like a movie like perfect example, like The Fog. When I was younger, The Fog was fine. Like we saw The Fog, I was like, okay,
it was good. Halloween,
right? But it's like that's the problem is like you got the bar set so high, you know, kind of thing. And as you get older, you can appreciate what's going on because you gotta be a little. The Fog requires you to kind of like understand a little more about the interconnection between people's relationships and different things like that. And then you know, and then of course, you know, when you and Luke and I talk about this all the time, when you become a parent, it changes how you look at movies, you know, drastically, like kind of thing. Movies that used to not impact me at all. And they're like, oh, how did I not understand that? Because I wasn't a dad yet, you know, kind of thing. And that's one of the things too, is that looking at some of those, you know, like the idea of the dumb teenagers, you know, whatever, because when we're seeing them now, like Luke and I were young, we're too young to see it all when it happened, when you know, in the theaters. We're watching it now, looking back at, the like when we were kids, how we remembered those kids in the 80s, the teenagers when we were like little, how teenagers were. I'm like, well, that's how people were. That's how people's hair looked. That's how like, that's what, you know, that's what it was. We remember those things. Nowadays,
that's what like, that's when teenage girls used to be named Linda.
So
when was the last time you met a Linda less than 50 years old? I ask you. It's been a hot minute.
Been a minute. So, So my daughter is 14 and she's into horror kind of thing. And she watches all this stuff. I mean, she grew up and you can see there's Bride of Frankenstein behind me. She literally has Frankensteins on her wall. She believed that people should not be, she believes people shouldn't be mean to each other. You should learn to understand each other. And that people are mean to Frankenstein because they don't understand him because he just can't communicate. Like that is where she was. Like I went as like a 3-year-old kind of thing. So when she watches horror movies with me and we watch old ones, we watch stuff like the classic stuff. She's always like, okay, Dad, but you know, in the 80s, you guys didn't have X, Y, and Z. Like you couldn't show those things. I'm like, well, yeah, that's true because we had to do it all with physical effects. And there's such a, we, you know, like are big fans of physical effects, obviously here kind of thing. Whereas, you know, you had to be ingenious in how you did those kills. How am I going to do this? Tom Savini was a master of doing those kind of things, you know, kind of thing. And that, I think that's one of the things that I don't want to say is lost, but you can see it now when they try to make, you know, kind of slasher movies nowadays, when they go to more physical, they keep it more physical and more, you know, makeups and stuff like that. Like the Hatchet movies. Much more makeups and very like kind of old school and how they kind of did certain things. I think there's an appreciation there that a generation who grew up loving slashers can truly appreciate those new movies, because it harkens back to those old ones. You know what I'm saying?
There's not a lot of how did they, it was, I mean, one of my biggest books when I was a little kid was, speaking of The Burning, was Bizarro by Tom Savini, which was just basically the basics of how to do special effects makeup. And, you would, it was, you could see how they were doing it, how they did that. And whenever a Star Wars movie would come up, they'd have a special effects documentary about it and all that. And there's no mystery to that nowadays. It's basically, although there is really the mystery of how they did that. And a lot of times you find out today that a lot of stuff that you would just assume was CGI, they still use practical effects sometimes, but now people just see it on the screen and they go, oh, well, it's obviously they just CGI'd that. So there's not the curiosity that, unless you're really like nerdily into, CGI effects and stuff like that, and you're at home working on your blender and stuff, then you want to know how they did that CGI effect. But the general moviegoer nowadays doesn't wonder about any, doesn't have to wonder about everything, because they could just go, oh, they CGI'd it, and it's, yeah, it's not as exciting, I mean,
Well,
that was half
nowadays,
of watching The Thing for the first time was half
oh
being
yeah,
terrified
oh
and
yeah,
half going, how the hell are they pulling this off?
I mean there is, I think you're right in one sense, but the nice thing is that I remember, when I started at Fangoria back in the 90s and Jurassic Park came out and everyone was convinced that everything should be CG, and it's nice that the pendulum has kind of swung back, because you have a lot of people who grew up on 80s horror now making movies, and they want those practical effects in there. There's a lot more practical makeup effects in horror movies now than there was maybe 10, 15 years ago. But yeah, I think you're right. I think we're in an age where, like, the assumption is you can do anything in a movie. With CG, you can make anything happen. And so there's a little less of the appeal of, like, how did they do that?
And I think when CG first started, they were like, we can do anything with the CG, we're going to do everything with it. And after a while, they started going, it might be cheaper and faster just to build this right now.
Well, just looked, a
And
lot of it
the
just
other.
looked, a lot of it just looked bad. Like, you had T2 and Jurassic Park where the effects are flawless, and then you get movies, as much as I like them overall, like The Faculty or From Dusk Till Dawn, where the CG is just terrible. It looks so artificial and it takes you right out of the film.
Yeah, that's something that we've talked about a lot, is that the real world versus an art, use the exact word, Michael, artificial, right? That we are, our mind, our eye and our brain can understand when something's real, even if we understand it's not really real, but we understand that's a guy in a suit, that's an appliance, right? Something like that, versus something that exists only as ones and zeros. And it is an element that takes us out as a film viewer. It breaks the mise en scène to have something that no one on set is reacting to, that doesn't exist in any physical space. It doesn't shoot the same way, right? Even a bad physical effect, to me, will hold up better than, other than anything really, than a top CG effect, because there's that unreality to it, right?
Well, I think the best example is Jaws. I mean, if you really look at Jaws, that doesn't really look like a real shark. It looks like a model shark, but it is there and it's full size and it's going after the actors. And even if it isn't, 100% believable as a real shark, you still get that sense of this 30-foot thing going after the actors, and it still looks brilliant.
I'm immediately reminded of the indie film Bad CGI Sharks, which, if you guys have ever seen, is actually, it's about a pair of brothers who are making a CGI shark movie, and the CGI sharks come to life and are actually attacking people in the real world. And at
Course.
one point, someone says, the shark doesn't look that bad, for the budget, right?
Well, one day
there,
there's
I
bad
think
C.
there, I think
Oh,
there are
go ahead.
enough bad CG shark movies already. We don't need one that actually celebrates it.
Goes
So,
meta.
I love shark movies, but even my 10-year-old self, I think, even would be like, what is this stuff? Where is this stuff coming from?
Well, in this case, I appreciate at least having a sense of humor about it. I I less appreciated, like I and I mentioned them before. I love Full Moon, Charles Band. I've backed many of his Indiegogos and such, and I've been a fan since the 80s. But when Full Moon ripped off these two indie guys that made this movie, I was like, do better, man. Come on. You're a I don't want to say a big fish, but you're a medium-sized fish. And these are two minnows that you just ripped off. So maybe do a little bit better, but that's neither here nor there. But,
the thing that really struck me was when Tommy Wiseau from The Room announced he was doing a CG shark movie. And it's like, that would land a lot harder if half of these things also didn't look like they were made by Tommy Wiseau.
Right.
Like,
how do you
Tommy Wiseau
parody?
doing a bad CG shark movie is kind of like, what's the phrase? I can't, but you know, a repetition or
yes.
I can't think of the word. I'm brain freezing, but it's like, yeah, there's enough bad CG shark movies out there. We don't need Tommy Wiseau doing one.
Right.
There's a lot of other people already doing them.
All I can think is Jaws, you're tearing me apart.
I mean, literally,
in a couple of decades, all the old.
The Kittner boy bad yelling, CGI "You're tearing movies. Me apart!" It's brilliant.
The old bad CGI movies are going to be viewed like, you know, the rubber dinosaurs in
1 Million BC,
the Time for God, or something like that. Yeah. You know, they're going to be like, "Oh, look at the, you know, robot monster and stuff. Look at this terrible Scorpion King CGI and stuff."
Yeah. Oh God!
It'll become
yeah.
camp and fun eventually. But,
call me when you get too kitsched.
Yeah, but I think though that's the that's, you know, correct. What I'm saying is I think that's what kind of makes us appreciate the better ones, right? You know, you can appreciate how good even to this day Jurassic Park looks, right? And made, you know, almost 30 years ago, right? Kind of thing. You're like, how great that looks still, you know, kind of thing. We can appreciate that, but I think we see that though too. Obviously, talking about slashers here, we can see that when you see. Well, you had the slashers that were kind of like really done on the shoestring kind of thing, as even if you like them, even if you enjoy them, right? You're just like, oh boy, okay. Like that you started appreciating the ones that are done better. I'm thinking like The Prowler, you know, The Burning. Yeah. I mean, I know Luke said if he saw Friday the 13th. I love Friday the 13th Part 7. It's literally that's my favorite. I'm not supposed to like that's my favorite one, but I love, because I have, you don't know this, I have Carrie from the cover of Cine Fantastique tattooed on my entire thigh, plus the Jason Voorhees on my shoulder. So literally when you got Jason versus Carrie, you know, and kind of thing, but that's the idea. You can appreciate those, the ones that are made better, the ones that had better story, the ones that had better effects, the one that had those little pieces of elements that, you know, Carpenter and Steve Miner and Sean Cunningham and those guys who were involved, who really knew how to make, tell a story. Friday the 13th, the original, has an amazing little piece that if you don't know to look for it, I mean, we know to look for it, but like when I blanked on her name, when she's screaming and you see the axe come back and it hits the lamp and it swings and it digs it into her head. It gives you a sense of weight and feel to that. We know to see that, but like someone who's just watching this for the first time goes, oh, that's a real axe, because it has weight. And, you know, even though we know they didn't bury a real axe into the woman's head, you know, I'm just saying, you know, it gives it that weight. Those little tiny things that are, you know, that are sometimes missing from movies that lend, you know, that next level to some of those slashers and stuff.
Well, that was a thing Savini did. He actually insisted on that. Mm-hmm. In The Prowler, for example, before, in the beginning, when he impales the two people on the pitchfork, you see him stick the pitchfork into the ground for no reason other than to establish this is a real metal pitchfork with real kind of force to it before you see him go after people with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in The Burning, he does the same thing with the when he takes the hedge clippers. And he cuts off all the fingers, right? It hits the
side wood,
of the boat. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
it hits the raft before he attacks a person with it.
Yeah. I mean, even the scene where he's putting it through. I mean, Kevin Bacon got the arrow through the neck in the original, and how and it just twists a little. That little twist sells that. I mean, now that we know Kevin Bacon's there and is a hell fake body and it's a whatever, but they couldn't get the blood to work, so they're blowing as hard as they can. And then it just pops up and it makes it so much better. Those little things that they would say, okay, that worked really well there. Let's use that here again. we call it, takes the he takes the in the burning, they take the blade right to the throat and he pulls it out and the blood just gushes out right there. Instead of it, like, you know, it even though that might not be as realistic as it would be in real life, if God forbid you took an arrow to the throat or whatever to the throat, you know, God forbid. Those things, your mind allows you to feel like, okay, yes, that's real. Like, you get that feeling, you know? Which is one of the things that I think, when we talk about, like, our, you know, we talk about your favorite horror movies, whether they're a slasher or not, one of the things that a lot of times we see is a through line through them is you know, as fantastical as the situation might be, there is still enough reality, the grounding things occurring. When the dog in Carpenter's The Thing, when the husky walks in and lays down, and you know something's up because that dog ain't right, you know, kind of thing, right? Its head splits open, like it's going crazy. But the dog trying to get out and biting at the cage, and like the other things occurring, all of those grounding in reality things allow this fantastical creature to evolve in front of you. That there's no way in the world you could ever imagine seeing this in real life. You would just pass out from seeing that happen in real life. But your mind's like, yep, that's a real dog, because it is a real dog trying to get out. There's real dogs in there. And that the Botin was able to do, I mean, his
that artistry is why that movie
right. But I'm saying is
when it came out, because it was too much for
people, right? Exactly. Yeah, but you have those grounding things, and I think, I'm sure you guys will talk about this in the documentary. There'll be stuff you guys where you can see those things that are those grounding elements that make it real, that people can then internalize and say, yes, I know how heavy an axe is. I know what it's like to see this. I've cut my finger. I've done those things. Like, I know those things hurt. And now I'm watching someone get their fingers sliced off. I can't imagine what that feels like, because nor do I want to. But the idea is that those grounding things, the giving everything weight, giving it mass, giving it those things, and shooting it in a way that, I mean, because we all know this, there are plenty of movies where you just hate, like, you want everyone to die. You just like, just kill them all. You know, let God sort them out, kind of thing, right? But when you have characters you actually start to feel for, you know, the nerdy kid who gets picked on all the time, whether that be in Terror Train or that be in, you know, The Burning, or that be in any other number of movies, you know, even down to like the Toxic Avenger, which is, you know, not slasher, but like it's pretty trashy kind of thing, you know, the idea that, you know, those characters that you can actually, you know, find reality in, to the person there, because the person sitting in the theater might be the jock on the date with the cheerleader.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It was for high school kids, and you got to see the jock get killed.
Get his comeuppance, right? Exactly. You know,
I don't know if I want to watch this anymore. You also knew
your date was going to be cuddling up to you every 10 minutes as the axe comes down. Yeah. So, you know, that was factored. That's not as much a factor anymore. You know, that's not how people consume movies anymore.
Right. Well, and this is just, I mean, and these guys know this. My wife is not a horror fan. That's an easy one to throw out there. Mike Kelly would say that. Took her to see when The Exorcist was re-released, when it was like, you know, they put the spider walk back in and whatever, which I thought was The Exorcist itself is, I mean, can be very terrifying to this day. When I took her, she had never seen it, and she's not a horror fan. And we're in a theater that's empty, and it's like, there's like, literally there was us and two other people, three other people in the whole theater. And the movie terrified her to her core, like, because she had never seen it. And it was so scary. And I knew what's coming, and I'm excited. So I'm like, oh, I can't wait to see what this looks like cleaned up. Oh, I can't wait to see the spider walk scene. Like, I'm excited because I love, you know, the horror. But remembering as a six-year-old when I saw The Exorcist, yeah, right? Because you were, yeah. So I was six, and Luke was, what, four?
I didn't see The Exorcist at
we
point,
watched
no.
The Omen. So I was five when I saw
The Omen. I remember watching The Omen.
We were five when I watched The Omen, and six when I saw The Exorcist, right? And I remember at 6 years old, knowing that, okay, this is a movie. No one really died, even though we know the curses, all the stuff that happened with The Exorcist and stuff later on. But, like, I know that kind of thing. But the idea that scariness, that terror, I don't think we can... that nowadays it's very hard to kind of get that reaction from an audience, right?
I was so scared of The Exorcist before I saw it, because I know my aunt, who was like a cigarette smoking Long Island, thick skinned, mm-hmm. you know, woman, not religious at all, not brought up religious, started wearing a cross for like 3 months after watching The Exorcist in the theater. She was wearing a cross, and like, movie shook me to my core. And you know, and the buildup of that, hearing that, those reports from right. people who went to see it, just built the power of the movie to.
Well, but isn't that part of even getting into back to slashers, right?
Yeah.
It's not just the hype and the buildup, but it's then the community experience,
yes,
right? One of my favorite,
to. Yeah.
One of my favorite experiences ever. And this is a very specific thing for me, right? So I mentioned Clemson University. In downtown Clemson, there used to be the Astro Triple. It was a very small 3-screen theater that showed second and third run movies for $1. Right. And then eventually they got slightly newer movies and they went to $1.50. And it was like a whole like crisis on campus. But anyway, so I went and saw Freddy versus Jason with a packed house mm-hmm. at the Dollar Theater. And it was one of the most fun experiences of my mm-hmm. life. Just everybody, because we had all seen it. I hope somebody didn't see it for the first time that way. But we're just hollering and screaming at the theater the entire time. And at one, I'm trying to remember what I think it might be when Kelly Rowland gets killed. A woman goes, "Girl, you stupid," right? And it's like that, and it's a plot. What else could you say but "girl, you stupid," right? That community aspect. And I think,
yeah,
you know, we that was something during COVID that we saw, right? That people were getting back into the community of watching film, that even if we couldn't be together,
right?
I could say, "Hey, Jay, I'm watching this. Do you want to mm-hmm. start the same time? We can watch it together." And now we can actually watch our movies together again. And I think that's something that slasher does really well,
yeah.
right? You go and you're heightened up, and then there's a kill, and then you laugh and look at the person next to you. You look at your friend, or you look at your date, or you look at your spouse, right? And you're like, "Oh my God, do you believe what we just saw?" Right? Right. You can't do that when you're by yourself.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know? Could, but people
you
look
could,
at you.
But the cat doesn't really answer, right? So,
yeah, that's what I was getting at, Michael. I was going to ask you, because again, obviously, you said you saw a lot of these kind of things in the theater and stuff like that. You know, that experience there, that obviously Luke and I didn't have as much of, kind of thing. The experience of watching and seeing these things in the theater with these crowds. You know.
Well, one of my favorite, I think I've told the story before, one of my favorite movie going experiences ever was seeing Halloween 2 on Halloween night. It was the first R-rated film I'd ever seen without a parent or an adult guardian. I went with a few friends, and it was great because everyone there, I'm sure, had seen the original Halloween. They were fans of it. They're excited to see more. And everybody was like cheering on Jamie Lee Curtis and screaming when the killer was going after somebody. And at one point, the marshal says something stupid, and everyone in the theater was like, "Shut up!" You know, it was just this great. I mean, I must say, a lot of the lower end slasher films, when I go to see them in a theater, there would not be a very big crowd there.
Right.
But Halloween 2, seeing that with like a whole room full of Halloween fans who were excited to see what mm-hmm. was coming next, and who were really responsive, you know, that was great. That was one of my favorite movie going experiences ever.
Yeah.
Once Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th were established as, you know, franchises.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a tradition, you know, when a new Nightmare on Elm Street came out, the whole high school was going to see it and fill in the theater. And it was the same with Rocky. I remember going to see Rocky 2, and the whole audience jumps up and on their feet and are jumping up and down like Rocky in the first movie, and popcorn's flying. And
I saw Rocky 3. It was because this was back in the day when movies could play for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And Rocky 3 opened Memorial Day weekend. I didn't see it with my family till Labor Day weekend. And it was still completely packed. People were like cheering, and like this kid a few rows in front of us was literally jumping out of his chair.
Yeah.
And that was great. That was so much fun.
Coming to the movies to ready to react to it, and ready to sort of play along with it. And you know, you get a little bit of that, like even with like I think the last movie I saw like that was what, you know, the one of the last two of the Avengers.
Yeah, Avengers Endgame. I'd say,
we
had people going
you would
bananas
have a
like that.
Theater, and everybody would be going nuts, but you just don't see that as much. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the most glorious experiences was seeing Natural Born Killers on opening night.
Oh my God.
And watching this packed theater and they were really getting into it. And then came the scene with Rodney Dangerfield.
Oh, yeah.
Getting creepy. And you heard this audience and they're like, oh, it's Rodney Dangerfield. We laugh at Rodney Dangerfield. He's a comedian. And they're laughing at the stuff he's saying. And then about, you know, a minute into it, they're going, ha, 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 ha. This isn't funny.
Well, one of my favorite experiences was seeing Full Metal Jacket. And I saw it in a suburban mall theater.
Yeah.
And there's this bunch of like teenage jock types sitting in the front row. And, you know, the first 20 minutes is just like Arlie Ermey out spewing invective. Yeah. And, you know, like everyone else, they were rolling and laughing. And, oh, this is really funny. You know, oh, you know, I bet you're a Peter Puffer, you know, that kind of thing. And then about halfway, not halfway through, you know, half an hour in, the laughter just dies. And when that movie ended, that entire row of like teenage jocks just got up and ran out of the theater. Because it freaked them out so badly. Oh, yeah. It was not what they had signed up for.
Actually saw that effect with Blair Witch Project.
Oh, wow.
I saw it first. I had a coworker who is best friends with our local movie reviewer's daughter. And so she would run off dubs of stuff that he was getting sent ahead of time. And they actually got a dub of Blair Witch Project on a VHS tape that was being shown to like this theater to be like, do you want to, you know, eventually get this movie? And he just brought it to me. It was a VHS type handwritten on it, Blair Witch Project. He just says, here, watch this. I'm like, what is this? And he's like, they brought this movie in for us to see if we wanted to have it at the theater. And I went home and like watched that alone in a room. And I was like, oh, this is terrifying. About 20, 30 minutes into it, I realized, okay, this isn't real. There's some acting going on here. But either way, it sucked me in and it had this whole thing. And then it was months before it came out in a theater.
Right.
And I was like right in line to see it in the theater. And it was when the street festival was going on. So there were all these younger people drinking beers and stuff. Oh, let's go see this horror movie. And so it was this like... Yep. You know, very energetic crowd, a little buzzed, and you know, this movie's got a reputation and stuff. And by the end of the movie, it was as if all of them had gotten hit over the head with a stick. There was just dead silence. And then after the last shot, probably about four or five women burst into tears and were like whipping out the door. I got to get out of here. It was wonderful. I was just waiting there going like, none of these people, you know, they're drunk. They're going to really think this is real.
Yeah. Well, I remember I saw it at an early screening right after it played at Sundance. And so I knew, of course, it was all, you know, staged. But I'm still at Fangoria, but, you know, when I was at Fango, we needed photos to run with our coverage. And, you know, they didn't obviously take stills during production. So I got a hold of a VHS copy. I won't say from where. And because, you know, I just needed it to pull frame grabs off. But then at the time I thought, well, you know, this is going to be kind of an art house movie. This isn't going to play in suburban theaters, you know, little bit. <of health. laughs> So I brought it home and I went over to a friend's place, you know, where I would have VHS movie nights on a regular basis. And we started watching it. And about 20 minutes in, this one guy's sister came back with her friend. They were both about 15 or 16. And they're like, what are you watching? And I said, oh, it's a documentary about these kids that went into the woods looking for this rip. And like 20 minutes in, they were like, one of them turns to us like, is this real? I'm like, yes, it is. And we had them fooled until the end of the crowd.
Good enough.
Yeah. They were completely sold.
To do that, yeah.
That is great.
Yeah.
I mean,
we saw it together. Luke and
yes,
I sorry,
we did.
We saw it
no,
together
no, yeah,
with
yeah,
our
yeah.
With
that,
Mike.
That is an example of a good lie.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, yeah. It's for
it's
the better.
It's not hurting anybody.
Yeah,
yeah no.
Right.
But the same thing happened. We like literally saw that the theater was packed. It was my brother, me and my brother are one of our best friends, and then my girlfriend at the time. We saw it there, and like you could hear a pin drop in that theater. And obviously the two jaded horror fans sitting there are like, it's gotta be crap. Like there's no way this is real. Like they wouldn't show us a snuff film. That doesn't exist, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. So, but people bought it
They were smart. They put out a documentary on TV before the movie came out.
On Sci-Fi Channel.
The movie.
It was exactly what they needed to do. That you can't buy that kind of marketing. And I think what
and
they
the website
did,
and all that, you know, it had that such a narrow window of time.
Yeah,
where the magic.
Where the internet wasn't quite there yet. Yeah, right.
You can still watch that movie and appreciate it. And the more I watch it, the more thought you see was actually put into what was going on. You know, everything means something in the movie, you know, when the noises that you would hear relate to other stories and stuff like that. But it takes a couple viewings to be like, okay, now's the part where the missing kids are out in the woods tormenting them or anything. But there was just this like maybe a month of where this movie was going to work its full magic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it became a big thing. And that dispersed a little bit of the, you know, enough of the magic where it just became a movie. But
the two things I want to say just about that. First off, I found recently on the Internet Archive the Scooby-Doo project, which if you've never seen it, is hilarious. From Cartoon Network, where they do their version of the Blair Witch Project with the Scooby gang. Secondly, Michael, your story about someone coming in midway through a movie. This movie has come up a lot this episode, but Sleepaway Camp. I had rented Sleepaway Camp from the aforementioned movies when I was I was working at Clemson at that point. And I was watching this in this apartment that I shared with my girlfriend, who's now my wife, and one of her friends who was a camp counselor, right? Like that was like one of her big things she did was like do like youth camps, right? And she, the roommate and the roommate's sister, who was also big into camp, came in like half an hour into this movie. And like, oh, what are you watching?
I said, Meatballs?
Yeah, no, I said, oh, it's a movie called Sleepaway Camp. And they start watching it. Like, they think it's a movie about this poor, shy girl, Angela, who's getting picked on and how she's going to find. And then, like, a few minutes, they're like, what are we watching? I'm like, I told you what it was. And then, of course, you get to the end of Sleepaway Camp, right? And I love films that are, like, accidentally relevant. Right, like that film is like more relevant now than it ever hoped to be when it came out, completely and unintentionally. Right, but yes, I'm sorry. Your story about telling, you know, not giving people no context to what they're watching is a favorite of mine.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you, Michael, is this. I mean, you said I'm actually, you know, working at Fango later on. You know, and again, I having never worked in publishing or anything. I'm a math teacher kind of thing. So, you know, I mean, you want to do Pythagorean theorem all day, buddy, but you know, that's not my thing. You know, one of the things that, at least I always found interesting, cause I have friends who work for Rue Morgue and when they, you know, kind of, and now all of them have moved on kind of thing. Jovanka's not there. Rodrigo's not there anymore kind of thing. Was getting the, you know, kind of having your finger on the pulse of what's happening, you know, kind of thing in the horror industry and what's coming up and what's going to be hot. Cause you got to put the, you know, you're not throwing the magazine together on Monday and then shipping it out on Friday. You know what I'm saying? Like it takes time. Did it at the tail end of the '80s into the '90s, when things started, I would say that is like the franchise was what slashers were, you know what I'm saying? When that transitioned to Scream, you know, the post, you know, kind of like that thing. I don't know how to ask this question. Did you guys, I mean, was that something that you guys were talking about back then? Or like the idea, like, you know, especially if you were, you know, of a certain age and having watched all these slashers in the '80s and then looking at grow into Scream and then what we eventually got after Scream, the post Scream era.
Well, when I started working there, it was 1990, and that was when horror was on a serious decline.
Okay.
Like the slasher franchises were over. There was not a lot of horror coming out, and a lot of what did come out was going straight to video because VHS had taken over.
Mm-hmm.
And Scream was never expected to be as big as it was. I mean, you know, Wes Craven was directing Force, but it was Miramax or Dimension, and Dimension did not like the word horror. Scream was a mystery thriller. You know, it was not sold as horror. And it was not even a big hit when it first opened. I think it opened the same day as Beavis and Butthead Do America. And Beavis and Butthead did 20 million for the weekend and Scream did 6 million.
Oh.
And so everyone went home for Christmas break thinking, well, it did okay. And then they came back and the movie just built this audience. So, you know, after this kind of like fallow period for horror that we'd been through for the past several years, we got to see horror kind of get revitalized by Scream. And then
3 years later by Blair Witch and The Sixth Sense. Yeah. And it was really exciting to be to kind of be along for that ride. And also we saw the rise of people like, I remember seeing Guillermo del Toro's Cronos for the first mm-hmm. time and thinking this guy's really got it. And, you know, watching him ascend and all the other people who came up through that period. So, you know, it was tough filling the issues for a while there. We were kind of scrambling to fill magazines in the 90s because there was just not a lot of
right.
new stuff coming out. And, you know, we did retrospective articles, of course, but in terms of new coverage, there wasn't nearly as much. And then by like 2000, 2001, it became an embarrassment of riches because there right. was so much stuff being made and coming out. You saw the rise of, like, Sundance had its midnight section, but now every festival was doing midnights. There were more horror festivals coming around, and horror just got so revitalized in the 2000s, and it remains to this day. It hasn't gone away. No. Like Weapons yeah. just opened to 40 million at the box
office. Yep.
Yeah.
Big. So yeah.
We were just talking about Weapon before you came on. We were talking, like, Chris and I were talking about Barbarian, and then we were talking about, and just like the idea, like, Weapons just opened. I really big brand to see this. My daughter, again, she's like, she likes her horror a certain way. She, like, she really enjoys the, like, she likes Smile and Smile 2, and she likes those kind of things, like the more mainstreamy kind of things. She goes, Dad, this Weapons movie looks like it could be really good. And I'm like, I just don't know yet. You know what I'm saying? If it's going to be too much for her, you know, emotionally, I don't know what's there yet, but it's one of those things that, like, it's now, we got commercial for Weapons happening on Bravo. Like, we're yeah. watching Below Deck, and I see, I'm like, I would never have seen a Friday the 13th commercial during, like, you know, whatever. I mean, there was no TV like Bravo back then, but I think, but you wouldn't see that now. You know, it's all the time. They had it on the football game.
Well, that's like what I was saying with Silent Night, Deadly Night. That's what got them into trouble, was they were airing during an inappropriate. Right. And right. now, you know, the thing is with cable, like, there is no appropriate time. Like, right. you can watch, yeah. you know, very adult oriented stuff at 2 p.m. because it's on streaming or cable mm-hmm. or whatever. Mm-hmm. So all those rules have changed as well.
Yeah.
Mm.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, and then this might be a hard question to answer, you know, like, obviously everyone has their favorite kind of, do you have, like, one or two go-to slashers that if you were someone wants to, like, who's never done this before? I mean, obviously Halloween's, like, everyone, like, you know, knows Halloween, I think. But is there something you could tell somebody with, like, hey, you want to see, go see this one. Like, these are the main, but is there, like, a hidden gem, or not even a hidden gem, like, but we would know it kind of thing. But, like, one or two that you would say are, like, the movies you want to get into this genre, here's like what you want to kind of do.
Entry point.
Well, there are a few of them that I especially like in kind of the post-Halloween period. Mm-hmm. My Bloody Valentine is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of Alone in the Dark. That one's really mm-hmm. clever and satirical. Yeah. And House on Sorority Row has a lot of really interesting directorial touches to it. So those are three that I would kind of say represent, like, the top end of the post-Halloween slasher trend.
I honest with you, I mean, seen them all. Obviously, kind of, we've talked about it, but those are three very different than each other. You know,
kind of thing. Completely. Yeah,
which is great. Yeah, you know, the remake of, like, My Bloody Valentine. I took my wife to see in 3D, which, you know, kind of thing. Well, that was a thing. You know, not now that it was like a, you know, like, this movie's in 3D was, like, only kind of, like, there wasn't, like, everywhere, right? The idea that she's watching this, she goes, wait, I know this movie. She was, because the movie opens, it's the end of the other movie. And I said, yes, this is like a sequel to what we just watched the other day, because I made her watch My Bloody Valentine, the original, before we went to the movies. Mm-hmm. And she's like, oh, okay. Because she really was going in thinking she was going to see the exact same movie again. But, you know, the movie's very, obviously, it's designed to be different and stuff like that. Those kind of entry points for people, it's, you know, we're trying to get, if someone's interested in being in that going into getting into the world of horror and slashers in general, it can be kind of hard sometimes, you know. Mm-hmm. I would very rarely ever suggest to someone to sit down and watch Maniac as the first time you sit down and watch a movie, because the movie's a little harsh at times. But yet when you watch Maniac, the blood and the gore at certain parts is still visceral. I mean, you know, Savini did, you know, well, it's the head and it gets the shotgun to the face kind of thing. But, you know, when he's cutting the head and stuff, the blood doesn't look real. But at the same time, by that point in the movie, you've already invested in that, where those are kind of hard movies to kind of have people jump in with, or even Sleepaway Camp. I mean, the end of Sleepaway Camp, my wife watched it with me. She goes, "What the?" She just jumps up. She goes, "What?" And I was like, "Oh, that's right. You didn't know that was happening." And I know it's coming, but it's like, you know, it's one of those things where you're trying to look at those places to get in with the slashers. Now, the one other thing I wanted to ask you was, obviously we're talking about like the slasher being the American thing. You know, the, like America, the Italian influences, obviously we see in, our slasher movies, you know, kind of thing. Is there like any in particular that you would like kind of say are some of your favorite that you can see like that you were, you know, it doesn't have to be Argento, it could be anybody kind of thing, you know, Bava, whoever.
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of especially opera and tenebrae. Mm-hmm. And we're gonna be covering in Slasher Trash some of the foreign stuff, like also some of the Australian ones, and also an emphasis on the fact that a lot of these movies came out of Canada. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of these kind of Canadian tax shelter, including My Bloody Valentine.
Right.
But yeah, tenebrae and opera are two of my favorite Argentos that are more you know, giallos are a little bit different from slasher films because they tend to focus on the people investigating the murders as opposed to the victims or the villains. But tenebrae and opera get as close to being slasher movies as Argento did. And they're both, you know, as I said, two of my favorites. They're both very stylish and very frightening and have some really memorable kill scenes in them. So, those two will definitely be something we're going to look at.
And I would all, of course, you know, we covered it here. Right. But the traditional one that you think of with is like the proto slasher is, you know, Twitch of the Death Nerve, you know, Bay of Blood or 14 other titles. And that one, I remember, like, I love Twitch of the Death Nerve. I like any movie that sounds like it could also be a punk band, you know, so that's just me. Right. But
that was the genius of Hallmark releasing, giving it that title.
Yes. Right. It stays with you. It's like one of my favorite crappy movies of all time. I think Jay knows where I'm going with this. Shriek of the Mutilated, which is, again,
I own it on Blu-ray.
you talk about movies, talk about hunting and finding movies on VHS and stuff. That was one that I found at the movies after finding on the old Bad Movie Report, which used to be off of stomptokyo.com. I'm going way back with the late 90s, early 2000s Intar webs here. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing. The Twitch of the Death Nerve, right? It, to me, is always, I consider it just a slasher because it's a perfect slasher.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, definitely. It's more of a slasher than a lot of the other. I mean, there are others like Torso is another one.
That's yes.
Yeah. So.
But it's so funny from Bava, who I always think of, you know, I think of like, Kill Baby Kill and, the Girl Knew Too Much and these kind of moody, atmospheric, the bit in... I think it's Kill Baby Kill where the guy is chasing himself and he catches himself, right? It's that kind of weird mind screw type of stuff. And then it's like, oh, you want me just to show people getting murdered? I can do that.
Yeah.
Here it is for 97 minutes. Enjoy.
Yeah. You know, the thing is too, is that, I mean, obviously Argento, you know, everyone, we're big Argento fans here kind of thing. Right. I think, but like, the idea, the stuff that Lucio Fulci put out, you know, kind of thing, like, now I'm blanking on it. New York Ripper.
New York Ripper, but even his giallo, right? Like Woman in Lizard Skin and Don't Torture a Duckling, you know, he always sort of lean again. I love Fulci. He wasn't quite as artistic or, you know, quite as, I don't know, careful as Argento. Right. So his stuff, it's like, again, light and get away. Right. Just get it moving.
But I'm saying is he, you know, even like, I mean, New York Ripper is, again, it still has the, you know, the Italian, you know, fingerprints on it. But it is so much like, you know, nowadays it's, you know, people look, I mean, it may not be a movie that is as readily available per se. I mean, you can find it if you're looking for it kind of thing, but it's not as mainstream as, you know, some other ones. But I'm watching that going,
what the kids today would say, New York Ripper is when you order Maniac off wish.com, I think is what.
Well,
and there's
isn't
nothing
that funny
wrong with that. If you're ordering off of wish.com, you know what you're going to get. Off of Temu. I guess the kids would say Temu now too, right?
But isn't there that comic book, I'm trying to remember, where it has
Maniac versus New York Ripper,
right? You know, kind of thing, you know?
Yep.
But it's one of those things that, obviously talking about slasher movies and talking about all those things that, they have their influences from different places and they took from different places. And they, it's funny, if you even go back as far as, like Psycho, kind of thing, like there's bits and pieces in Psycho that you can see sprinkled in, later on with Carpenter and, because, but, and even, you would see it. Wes Craven would eventually have things in Scream and whatever. They would go and pull those things in because being able to create this whole different genre of horror, you have to have your influences places, you don't directly do exactly what they did, but you're pulling those things in. And I think when we look at horror, the evolution of how horror has changed over the years, and how things have become much more accepted in a movie. Like the things you can get away with in, I mean, there was a time when Silence of the Lambs would just be called a straight up horror movie, would never have been up for an Academy Award, whatever. But I mean, it's not called a horror movie. It's called a psychological thriller. But he's a cannibal. They're killing people. The other guy's skinning people and wearing their skins. Like, what? Kind of thing. Like, that's Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You know what I'm saying? So,
It was more gruesome than Texas
oh, it
Chainsaw
was. Oh, I
Massacre
agree. What I'm
by a
saying is, but there
long
was a
shot.
time when there's never would be that would not be mainstream. But Silence of the Lambs, I mean, that was accepted. It won the Academy Award for crying out loud. And like, I think when we see those things, there has to be those pieces that came before. There has to be the building blocks that are there. And obviously, you guys are going to be talking about in this documentary is the slasher movies and they had their growth and all their different stuff where they're coming from. And I hope people, really can, if they're not as well versed, will spend the time to go back and look at and watch those kind of things and become more well versed.
Well, that's part of
Speaking of which,
the goal of the documentary.
yeah,
It's, you know, we, you
yes.
know, the people who love these movies, we want to deliver for them, but also for people who may not know either the history or some of the more obscure variations on the theme, we want to introduce people to a lot of stuff too, and have them say, "Oh, that's." I mean, part of the great thing is Gareth Slasher Trash Morgan. The whole thing kind of is based on his Facebook group, and he's one of the producers on the doc, and he knows as much, if not more, about these movies than I do. And so we can really kind of we're tapping his knowledge as well of all of these films and all of the trends and all the important titles to kind of spotlight and to let and also to let people know about that they may not have heard of before.
Yeah, which is
Well,
great.
pop culture is really into gruesome documentaries these days, so.
Yeah, well, I'm not a fan of like the true crime stuff, but this is all fiction, and we're celebrating, the fun of it as well as the scares of it.
And I think obviously people who have been listening have heard me espouse In Search of Darkness, all the different ones, right, kind of things. Like the three from the 80s and the new nine, the 90s one that just came out and the new 90s one that's being worked on and stuff, which I know you've been part of. There when you when like the first In Search of the Search of Darkness, the first number one, I mean, I'm going through. I'm like, people are like, well, how many of those movies have you seen? You had the checklist, check them off. And I'm like, I've checked every one of them. Like, I've seen every one of these movies. And then we got to part two, and I'm like, oh wait, I remember. I'm trying to remember if I've seen that. By the time we got to three, we got to the like direct to video and things like that. That got to movies where I'm like, oh, I've never seen that movie, and now I got to go see it. Like, it became something as a horror fan. I wanted to go become more educated, and what we hope to do is obviously we bring what we cover current movies and we're covering like Luke said the horror rack hangers on. We're trying to get people exposed to different things, and I appreciate and I can I'm I know these guys will too. We appreciate the idea of like trying to give people who might not be as well versed in it a place to come and find out about it and learn and
Yep.
celebrate what we have, because we're in a day and age where everything is so much more available than it ever was, then you can go do those things. This would have been very, very hard to do in 1985,
Yeah,
kind of
completely.
thing. So, and we started talking about VHS and things like, and like there was a time when you could go and like I said, I would go get something from the gray market, and you're like, I haven't seen this, and I want to see this movie, and you're now able to kind of see those. And but there is something still to be said about sitting down in that communal experience of the VHS night or watching a movie, or like Luke used to do the little movie fest with all his friends and whatever. We would sit down and watch horror movies. And that communal experience, I think the slasher movie, was, especially when you got to the franchises, 100% with the franchises, with the Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street and stuff, those were about Friday night. Going out, taking your date to the movie, you're not old enough to be here, but come on in, buddy, kind of thing. And that was what it was. It was a communal experience, and that's something that is hard to replicate in that same feeling, because obviously you have to be sitting in the theater and doing all that stuff. But you can replicate that, or share that with people, of all those great memories and those things that were so important and helped kind of form. You
Yeah.
know who you are as a viewer, as a consumer, as a whatever they might want to look at it like,
It's also a history of, the historical, important historical information about cinema. And it really hasn't been as covered in a visual medium. In books and stuff, you've always been able to scare up books and magazines on the horror genre that would go granularly in depth to it, but having a series of documentaries that lay it out piece by piece, that's going to be an important part of it is an important part of film history, and it's a part that gets neglected a lot because people are like, oh, the Western, the historical romance, period pieces and stuff like that. There's plenty of stuff like that, and people talk about Hitchcock and stuff like that, and sort of skirt the horror
Yeah,
genre. But
that's what we're trying to do with Slasher Trash, is really celebrate this whole era with a in-depth in a way that hasn't been done before.
I tell you right now, the day it launched, I backed. I was like,
I
I'm
live
in.
for stuff like this. I mean, nowadays, well, just a little history. Like 2 years ago, I had a fire at my house, burned everything gone, and 40 years of collecting stuff. And now, so now when I find old horror, the old horror mags I have, they're the most incredible resource ever, and I'm sort of re-experiencing, finding them in a store. It used to be like Fangoria and Famous Monsters and stuff. Actually, Famous Monsters was how I heard about Friday the 13th. Famous Monsters had a picture of the axe in the head, and when I was a kid, I was like, oh, geez, this has escalated a little bit from what I'm used to in Famous Monsters, and when I find those old, the psychotronic magazines and stuff, where it just goes as deep as, you'll have in-depth interviews with, sort of obscure Corman character actor that's been in a bunch of really low budget movies, and they're more interesting than an interview with Tom Cruise, frankly, and having that as a resource is, just incredible. So movies like your movies are just like crack form of entertainment for me,
We definitely can. Obviously, being horror fans and stuff, but it can't be said enough how important it is to not everyone likes the same stuff, which is fine, kind of thing. That's why there's 31 flavors, kind of thing. But for fans, of horror, and fans obviously, and in particular of slashers, this is a great opportunity. I literally, the day it was launched, I was like, I'm backing this. I knew it was coming. As soon as I got launched, I was like, I was home. I was like, I backed it immediately, and I sent it to my buddy Damien, and I sent it to my buddy Chuck, and I sent it to these guys. I just started sharing it because I'm like, you got to get a part of this. And what happens is that, I
Well, we
mean.
need to tell our listeners how they can
Yeah,
ship some money over to
exactly
more of
right.
this.
Right.
Yeah, you go to slashertrashdoc.com and all the information will be there. We also have a
All right.
Facebook page. We're on all the social media. So
Just search out Slasher Trash wherever you can, and it'll all direct you back to how you can help crowdfund us.
Yeah. Also, folks, when you're doing that too, and you should go back. I cannot wait for this. Creative VC, obviously a creator, yeah. VC, excuse me. In Search of Darkness 1, 2, and 3, the 90s, the first, but 90 to 94,
yeah,
right. And also In Search of Tomorrow, if for our sci-fi fans, holy cow, is that good? That blew me away. All those, I love them. The action hero one, the first one, the way back in the day, the In Search of a Hero kind of thing was great. Don't get me wrong, but like the horror ones, if you're into horror or In Search of Tomorrow, all of these are great, and all of them are available. You can go pick them up as well. I know some of them were on Shudder for a while. You could watch them through there and stuff like that. But like the stuff there that you guys are putting out, top notch. It is exactly what. If you're truly like, if you want to, you know, learn and be a fan of all this stuff, this is the stuff that we can, you know, in, you know, take it in, ingest it. I always tell people all the time, I might not learn something new every single time I'm watching. Like I've watched through them a bunch of times, but there's movies that I'm like, I haven't seen that movie in 25 years. I want to watch that movie, and it brings it back. And yeah. Like Luke said, you know, all these little, like, you know, Vinegar Syndrome is putting syndicates putting this out, or, you know, whoever, like Vestron movie, like those are, there's coming out with these movies now that might not have, there was a time when you just kind of talked about it. Like, hey, remember that movie? Yeah, we can't see it now because it's 1986 and you can't get you're not available unless you have, you know, whatever, because they don't have it all the time, you know, kind of thing. Or you went to the movie, you know, if you didn't have, if you only had like the Blockbuster, the more mainstream thing that didn't actually carry the stuff that was mom and pops were willing to carry. So, you know, Michael, I just want to say thank you very much for coming on with us.
Oh, my pleasure. You know, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we love... obviously we love having people who love movies as much as we do and the kind of movies we love. And, we love picking your brain and hearing all about the stuff here. And, you know, we're looking forward to everything that you guys got coming out, you know, Slasher Trash, of course, and whatever is the next thing, you know, too, and keep pushing it. And I, for one, will every time I get to share it, I will share it on social media as much as I possibly can, because I want people to be, you know, being supportive and being part of this, you know, community that, you know, is, you know, it was kind of hush hush for forever. And now we can be, you know, who we are and don't have to be embarrassed by watching.
And if you ever saw anything in media about horror, it was usually only the most surface level of stuff. It's like, okay, we'll go over the universal monsters and this and this and work our way up to Scream or whatever. And that's not what the horror fan wants.
Right.
They've covered all that stuff by the time they were 12 years old. So this is just,
yeah, we're going to get much more. We're not actually covering the whole post Scream thing. It's going to be strictly like the 80s slash, you know, we're going to talk about the earlier films that influenced them, but it's going to be really like the post Halloween, Friday the 13th, that whole 80s era. Awesome. It's really going to be the focus. Awesome.
Yep. Right in our wheelhouse. That's what that is. Yep. So.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, there's always room for another movie too. Afterwards, if you can't get it all in one, there's always another one down the line.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. So like I said, Michael, thank you very much for coming on with us. Listeners, please go check it out. You know, be supportive of them. The pre-sale goes, I want to say, to the 14th of August.
Yes, I believe so.
Okay. So, you know, we're going to get this out ASAP. I'm going to be sharing stuff online again tonight, you know, get out there and do these things. Please, if this has any interest to you at all, please back them. This is, you know, I know it's going to be good. I mean, I haven't seen it yet, but I know it's going to be good because I know the players involved in this, and they always put out quality stuff. And, you know, that's someone that, you know, and as physical media collectors, as you know, some we are, you know, to me, getting the idea of having a Blu-ray of it right on the shelf next to, you can't see it here, but there I have all of the In Search of Darkness right here, literally next to me on the couch, kind of thing. So,
and cool. Whenever there's a filmmaker on one of my podcasts as a film student, I always have to say, I'm always just amazed. You know, I'm so impressed by any, from the worst movie ever, if you can make, if you get one movie made in your lifetime, it's an amazing task. And for you guys to have done so many of these, I know, like, just the the cost that has taken on your life and the amount of effort to do it, and I really appreciate it and admire
Thank
it.
You.
It's yeah. It's just always good to see something
Thanks.
Get done. Even get done, just getting it done is an amazing feat, and getting
yep.
it done and having it be good is a miracle. So yeah congratulations.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So all right, folks. So like we said, check it out. Michael, again, thank you very much. You're more than welcome to come back anytime you want to talk about movies. We, you're always
sure,
welcome.
Sure, I'll
with
do
us.
That for sure.
Oh yeah, we're always welcome with us. We definitely enjoy that. So,
yeah,
all right, folks.
I'd like to do some like top 10 lists.
Oh,
with the four of us would be pretty
okay.
Fun.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, it's one of those things that you know, we appreciate people who love the movies that we love, and we love talking about them, and we appreciate you giving your time to be here with us, you know, in our little world we live in kind of thing. And, you know, we love having you with us here. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So, folks, until next time, you know, here at the vault, you know, again, hit us
what
up.
What are we doing? We're probably doing.
I have no idea what's next.
I have no idea.
We'll be doing a hanger on next.
We might be doing a hanger on next. We'll have to see. So
yeah, my notes are, my notes for the lineup are downstairs, yeah, so I can't grab them.
But we'll be back with it.
I know the new movie that we're doing next is going to be Sinners down the line, but I think there's a Horror Rack.
Yeah, because we just did what?
The Monkey.
The Monkey. Yeah, and then we got Sinners is the next new one. But anyway, next Horror Rack hanger on, which kind of fits with this idea we're just talking about here. Be supportive. Again, Michael, thank you very much for being here. To all our listeners, thank you for the downloads and the listens. We all appreciate all the support that we get here at Two True Feeks. So until next time, folks, see you at the movies.
Once upon a time, on a sad Valentine, in a place known as Hanigermine, a legend began. Every woman and man would always remember the time. And those who remained were never the same. You could see the fear in their eyes. Once every year, as the 14th draws near, there's a hush all over the town. For the legend they say on a Valentine's Day is a curse that'll live on and on. And no one will know as the years come and go of the horror from long time ago.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks. If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Test, test, say duh.
Duh.
Good luck.